but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Did you watch the World Series? Did you watch Game 7 of the World Series? Did you see the literal inches that separated the Dodgers and Blue Jays in what was a magnificent World Series? I mean, I got to say, from an entertainment perspective, watching the Blue Jays and Dodgers, it delivered. I mean, it delivered drama in Game 6. It delivered theater in Game 7. Every time I turned around, it was like, you know, here was Shohei Ohtani pitching early in the series, and then that extra inning marathon game in which Ohtani reached base 9 times, and then it became about other characters. It became about a second baseman that nobody was talking about who makes a great play and hits a home run. It becomes about an outfielder, a defensive replacement in the late innings for the Dodgers, making a stunning catch coming from center field like Kelly Leak in the Bad News Bears, and taking the ball over the shoulder of the left fielder. It was a remarkable World Series. And it got me thinking about the entertainment value of what we saw, right? Like, the Blue Jays were within a whisker of winning a World Series. You know, at home plate and a bang-bang play, you know, that maybe they win it all. It felt like at every turn the World Series had it. In the NFL, what do we have? We have close games that are one-score games, more one-score games than ever in history in the NFL, more one-score games than any point in history in college football. You watch the overtime action where Miami and Mario Cristobal blow a win. You see Oregon State and Washington State coming down to the wire. It's wide right. It feels as though, and I don't think it's just a feel, it is, we are seeing more close, highly entertaining games than at any point in history in sports. Sports has figured something out. The NFL, probably first to the table ahead of everybody else, but certainly the World Series delivered, and it really does have me thinking about the entertainment value in sport. The rule changes that have been made to, you know, level the playing field, the way the games are officiated and how they feel closer than ever, clock management more advanced than ever, the teams in general, the fostering of parity within the leagues and within college football. We're seeing a real leveling of the playing field, even in college football, where some of the perennial powers just don't have the normal space that they used to have in competing with others. Like, money has equalized some things in college football. But it got me thinking, like, it used to be back in the day when I went and covered an NBA Finals, for example. I would walk around the building, covered a bunch of NBA Finals and Super Bowls and World Series and whatever. But the NBA, I noticed that the badges of a lot of the NBA employees, they didn't say the NBA. It said NBA Entertainment on their credential. And it was the first time I really thought about sports with the context or the framing of sport being about entertainment. And, you know, we think of professional wrestling as entertainment, and I don't want to really draw too deep on that comparison, but it's true. It's an entertainment business. But really, the sports games themselves are what? They're built around TV and viewership. And so it makes sense to me that we're getting an 18-inning marathon series. In 7 games, not 4. There's a lot more money in it. And I'm not saying that it's in a conspiracy within the series, but I'm saying there is a conspiracy, a larger conspiracy that I think exists in sports that has to do about parity. It has to do about fostering competitive balance. It has to do about fostering competitive games that are one-score games. And even in the expanded era, this expanded era, if you think about it, of college football, where, you know, we don't really fret about a team losing a game because, you know, you probably, if you're in a Power 4 conference, can afford 2 losses and still get to the playoff. more games, longer playoff in college football, longer playoff and a longer season in the NFL, more the additional wild card series in Major League Baseball. What does it all point to? It points to TV and money. Points to the entertainment value that sports knows it has to deliver when it comes to TV and money. These billion-dollar leagues are funded by hundreds of millions of dollars in television revenue every year. The Big Ten Conference, the SEC, we saw the money flying around in front of all of the college football world. Now we are watching these new TV deals, including the deal with the NBA and certainly the NFL streaming on Amazon and Netflix getting into the game. The ability for live sports programming to drive viewership on television is not new. It's evident. But I am left wondering about the entertainment value of the games we're seeing and how made for TV everything feels. Didn't the World Series feel that way a little bit to you? That it wasn't just about the two best teams, the team from the National League and the team from the American League, playing it out. There was an entertainment and a value of theater that was brought to the game. There was a theater delivery. You know, even the, hey, the ball stuck under the outfield fence moment where hands go up. And certainly the infield's in and it's a bang, bang play. It all, to me, felt, a little manipulated by maybe the circumstance of these leagues creating parity. But man, are we being led to believe that the competitive balance in college football and the competitive balance in the NFL and the competitive balance in Major League Baseball are all coincidentally narrower than ever? Or is something else going on? I have my theory. I think it's about the competition that these leagues have for television dollars. Baseball did what? Sped the games up. Wanted the games to move quicker and be more interesting. It wanted to drive viewership. The NFL creates a bunch of rule changes, creates parity and fosters parity within the leagues, wants a longer season, wants a longer postseason. Why? There's more television money in it. It's not really about the players. It's not really about the fans. It's about the TV dollars. College football, spanning the playoff, making the season longer, consolidating within the Power Four. Why? Because, hey, they want more TV money to go around with fewer people getting it. I'm left watching all of this and thinking to myself, gosh, are we going to stay in this era, in this sweet spot, where competition is just tighter than ever, and that's the way it's going to be? Or will, in college football in particular, will some outliers separate themselves? Because as much as I want to follow the money and just make it all about money, I think the bigger thing that's happened is there's been a little bit of a leveling of the playing field when it comes to the money. Everybody can spend $20.5 million if they choose, or you decide how to distribute your revenue within your athletic department. The NIL collectives, well, they don't have a limitless budget, at least at most places, so it does kind of create a soft salary cap where you've got, the market for players staying within a range. But I am curious to know what you think as you watch things, and I am going to encourage you as you you absorb the World Series, which I think was amazing. And I love that it wasn't just about Shohei Ohtani going out and pitching and winning MVP and hitting a bunch of home runs. It wasn't even about Freddie Freeman or Mookie Betts. It was about the rest of the Dodgers, particularly in Game 7. It was the other guys who went and won that series. And so even as a Giants fan, I'm looking back and I'm going, that really was about the depth of the Dodgers. It was about the other guys in the clubhouse. And gosh, how close were the Blue Jays to actually pulling that off? And I am left looking at college football and going, okay, you've always had Ohio State at the top. We've always had, an SEC school or two at the top. Oregon certainly is spending at the top. But we're going to get this first set of college football playoff rankings tomorrow. And there's bound to be a bunch of controversy and people bellyaching, and the conferences are all going to be upset, and the commissioners are going to be upset. And I think everybody's going to be up in arms over the potential that, there's favorable treatment for the Big Ten and the SEC within this thing. I expect Brett Yormark of the Big 12 is going to be out pandering. I expect you'll see the ACC pandering. You'll see individual coaches within the conferences bellyaching about what they didn't get. Everybody's trying to lobby the committee. I think certainly you're going to see ESPN, TV partner of the ACC and SEC, really trumpeting the programs that are within those conferences. You're going to see Fox out talking about its partner, its biggest partner in the Big Ten. It's going to want like four or five members of the Big Ten to get in there. Who's the fourth Big Ten team? That's a big question I have moving towards tomorrow's reveal of the first set of rankings. But within that, I'm looking around at other schools and I'm going, okay, what can the others learn from this time of entertainment and this time of great parody? You know, Oregon State, everyone wants to point to Trent Bray being the thing that went wrong at Oregon State. I think there's some other things that went wrong at Oregon State. How about Malik Murphy getting $1.5 million? Guy that throws three passes last Saturday. Despite Oregon State winning, Malik Murphy, you know, what do you get, $500,000 a pass in his, you know, his salary? Malik Murphy, $1.5 million, mostly sitting on the bench. Jabari Johnson, by the way, I'm told $50,000 player. Jabari Johnson getting $50,000, Malik Murphy getting $1.5 million. Is the mistake by Oregon State, is it more of a general manager mistake? Is it more of a, hey, wow, they allocated the dollars in a way that didn't really make sense, too much money on one guy? You know, and you can't afford to do that if you're a school like Oregon State. I mean, it's possible that the biggest sin of Oregon State football wasn't Trent Bray, that the biggest sin was giving Malik Murphy $1.5 million. I mean, it's entirely possible that Jabari Johnson, $50,000 player, you know, he's essentially led them to two wins. Granted, the schedule got easier. Granted, they could have very easily lost on Saturday, but they found a way. And so you give Oregon State credit. I guess if I step back and I think about all of this, the Dodgers, the close games in the NFL, the close games in college football, watch these one-score games more than ever. More than ever, we're seeing one-score games within the top 25 and elsewhere. Tight games, late lead changes. You know, even Cal's game, you know, over the weekend, they had a chance there at the end. They had the ball. They're down three, and they throw a pick six going the other way. The final score looks like it's a double-digit score. But that was a game Cal had a chance to drive down and try to win at the end of regulation. I am looking at all of it and looking in the totality of everything that we're seeing in sports. And I am seeing high entertainment value, higher than ever. What TV doesn't want is blowout games. It wants closely matched teams. It wants high rankings. It wants eyeballs. It wants one score games. The NFL figured that out, right? By fostering all this parity. I think we're watching the other sports catch up now. We're seeing it in Major League Baseball. I think we're seeing it in college football. I think you're going to see it elsewhere as well. All right, we have a great show for you today on this Monday. Of course, we're going to talk about the Dodgers winning their World Series. Congrats to them and to you Dodger fans out there. Everybody hates you. All you do is spend and win. But I don't think that series did anything more than just entertain the whole country. It was a great series. Blue Jay fans, I feel for you. Mariner fans, if you could have got to the World Series, I think you had a puncher's chance to win the whole thing as you look back. Can the Mariners get back next year? Whole big question. Of course they can get back. Of course they have the pieces to get back. Yes, it'll be a gut-wrenching experience to encounter the offseason and see what they do or don't do or what the roster looks like going into spring training. But if you're a Mariners fan, think about how good you feel maybe this offseason versus maybe some of the off-seasons of the last decade. And if you're an Oregon fan, I think you look at the college football season and you think, gosh, should they get in the playoff? I mean, could they beat anybody on a given day? Of course. Could they lose and get knocked out? Of course. If you're an Oregon State fan, maybe you see this as, hey, the path to a rebuild is easier than ever now in college football. It's not as hard to rebuild as it once was. So Oregon State facing a little bit of a rebuild and the potential hiring of a new coach. And we'll talk about that later. Would you welcome Jonathan Smith back? Is Rob Akey the guy? What does Oregon State need? We'll talk about that coming up in hour two. We will also talk about the Trailblazers, who have become a fun, exciting story. They are, you know, 4-2 through the first six games of the year. Got to give credit to Joe Cronin. Got to give credit to Tiago Splitter. As despite the whole Chauncey Billups thing, I think the Blazers largely starting this year with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of hope. And I think that's all we could ask for as we look at the Trailblazers. But we're in an era of entertainment, are we not? Are you not entertained? Oregon with a big game against Iowa. Oregon State looking for a coach. I want you to leave it here. Coming up next, I'll talk about all of that. You got the bald-faced truth on the BFT Radio Network. Leave it locked in.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I spent some time in Corvallis on Saturday. Oregon State beat Washington State. As I mentioned, good win for the Beavers. They beat Washington State. Like I told Rob Akey, the coach at Oregon State, I told him, been so long since Oregon State lost a game, I think they forgot how to lose these games. Akey saw me on the sideline during pregame warmups. He came over, said hello, and I thanked him for coming on Wednesdays. He joins us every Wednesday. He'll join us this Wednesday coming up. But Oregon State caught lightning in a bottle, 10-7 win over Washington State. Like, Oregon State was happy, but not storm the field happy. Fans stormed the field after the Lafayette win a couple weeks ago. You know, the Beaver fans were happy, but they're not storm the field happy. I think Washington State, you know, was probably more upset with how they played. Zevi Eckhouse, quarterback at Washington State, did not play well. Bad Zevi came out to play. Give Oregon State some credit for that. They put some pressure on him and put him in a tough situation. Before the game, I got a chance to sit down with Jayathi Murthy, the president at Oregon State. She has been on the show a couple of times before, but she granted me a one-on-one interview in her suite. I had a really interesting talk with her. I'm going to play some of that coming up. But I also ran into Ed Ray, Dr. Edward Ray, the former president, two presidents ago. Because remember, F. King Alexander, the F. King disaster, came between Jayathi and Ed Ray. And you talk about, you know, a guy who's a little cantankerous. Ed Ray is that guy. He's 81 years old. He's still teaching part-time at Oregon State and doing some things with the school. Still going to the football games because I ran into him. And, you know, he gave me a fantastic quote about how your identity doesn't mean anything anymore in sports. Your identity means nothing. It has to do now. Your success has to do with your ability to raise funds. And if you can raise the funds, you matter. And if you can't raise the funds, you don't matter. And that's pretty much it. And, you know, he mixed in a couple of profane words and we talked for a while, and not lost on me that, you know, Ed Ray, while a lot of people at Oregon State sort of look at him and go, gosh, he was great. What a legacy he has. His wife's name is on one of the buildings there across the street from Research Stadium. But also, he was a big-time proponent for Larry Scott, the former Pac-12 commissioner. You talk about the downfall of the Pac-12 conference. That happened on Larry Scott's watch. Ed Ray, the president at the time at Oregon State, was just a big backer of Larry Scott, legacy Pac-12 president, who thought Larry Scott was the greatest thing ever because Larry Scott happened to be the commissioner when Oregon State negotiated a full share. Remember, Oregon State got the same amount of media rights money as USC and UCLA. So did Washington State. Everybody got the same amount of money. That happened on Larry Scott's watch. It was probably one of the precursors, one of the many precursors to the downfall of the Pac-12 conference, because over time, USC and UCLA developed some really bad feelings over having to subsidize what they thought was subsidize the schools in Pullman and Corvallis. I think it's an interesting conversation to have, especially while these two teams are playing each other like they were on Saturday, and then think about them playing again on November 29th, and then moving off into their new conference in 2026 where they're going to play others. Ed Ray's words, ringing in my ears, your identity doesn't matter. What you have been in the past does not matter, good or bad. Like LSU, that used to mean something. You know what means something now? Having enough money to go pay players, to pay coaches, to have resources. That's what matters now. And so it doesn't matter if you're Alabama or you're Oregon State, you got the same problem. You got to go out and raise money. And, you know, granted, the SEC schools have a media rights deal that gives them an inherent advantage, and so do the Big Ten schools. But everybody else is chasing. And I think we're going to watch that in the next cycle, in the next 10 years. And so it was interesting to me to talk to Jayathi Murthy, the president, the current president, and then bump into Ed Ray, the former president. Isn't it funny how that stuff happens? Do you ever have that happen where, like, you're thinking about a friend or you're talking about a friend, and then suddenly you get in your car and that friend will text you, or you go down the street and you bump into somebody and you're like, dang, just thinking about this person, and here they are. That kind of you know, just shook my head as I walked away from my conversation with Ed Ray, because I was like, damn, I just had a conversation with, you know, the president that has replaced his replacement. And now here I am bumping into Ed Ray. It was like seeing an old friend. I've only seen him like twice since he left his big desk in his office at Oregon State. But you can read all about that at johnconzano.com if you want to read my column about bumping into Ed Ray. But I want you to hear the words of Jayathi Murthy right here on the show. I talked to her in her suite for about 30 minutes, interviewed her. Full interviews on the YouTube channel. Just search for John Canzano on YouTube. But I pulled out a couple of cuts here because I want to talk about this. I think it's interesting because we've talked on this show about NVIDIA and Jensen Huang and how Oregon State should be making a play for the NVIDIA founder. Like, what Jensen Huang could do for Oregon State dwarfs everything that T. Boone Pickens did for Oklahoma State. It dwarfs what Phil Knight has done for Oregon. If you think about it, if Jensen Huang got on board at Oregon State with AI and with a company that has a market cap of $5 trillion, I think Oregon State could become a major player in college athletics in a way that the Beavers probably could not wrap their minds around a decade ago. He so far has not shown any interest in sports, but I asked Jayathi Murthy about the possibility of recruiting Jensen Huang. Can they bring him in on this hire? And I don't know if she got my question or not, because I said, you know, can you involve him? Can you involve NVIDIA on this hire? And here's what the president at Oregon State had to say.
I'm sure you've thought of this, but yeah. Why not bring him in on the hire? Why not get NVIDIA invested in helping with the hire? Is there some kind of AI component that that can be utilized by the athletic department here?
Well, I mean, so Jensen is the CEO of a $5 trillion company. $5 trillion. I mean, Just think about it. This is probably the most valuable company in the world. And, you know, he's got the tiger by the tail. All right. This is a fast-moving world and lots of competition. So I don't know that football is the highest thing on his mind. So I will tell you that OSU is very dear to him. So I don't know that I would involve him in this kind of detail. I think that's really our job, and we ought to do our job right.
Can you use AI, though? I mean, could Oregon State become the AI athletic department?
I think there's absolutely a role for AI in athletics, right? Of all kinds, and there are people already working on these things. Athletic data, for example, has a lot of rich information, and certainly we're entering an era where both college athletics and professional athletics will have plenty of AI in them if they don't already. Yeah. So there's certainly that kind of role. Is there a role for a choice of coach? I don't know. This needs to move very fast in the next month, so not yet, I would say. But even more than that, I mean, OSU has the opportunity to become the AI university in Oregon, all right, to be the source of AI knowledge and AI help and AI coaching and consulting all across Oregon. We've got the Huang Center coming up. It's going to be ready end of December. The big computer will be here early 27. We are plotting and planning every day to see what particular advantages we can bring to.
First of all, I love that she refers to that supercomputer, which will be the world's fastest computer, as the big computer that will be here in the, you know, Oregon State planning all around that. And certainly, certainly it's a delicate thing when you've got somebody who's worth the kind of money that Jensen Huang is worth, right? And the ability for him to write a $50 million check is nothing. He's blinking, and it's very little to him. But it makes all the difference in the world to his alma mater, who is sitting back probably wanting to go back to the well and ask and ask and ask. And people who are in university relations, donor relations, will tell you that there's an art to this. There's a dance to this that, you know, you don't want the athletic department asking him for money while you've got, you know, the president asking for money, while you've got the foundation asking for money, while you've got individual disciplines. Well, he took a class in anthropology. Well, he took a class in music. Well, he took a class. Like, you've got everybody at the university with their hand out to the point where you turn the donor off, right? So there's a you know, a little bit of a dance to this. Back in the day, the University of Oregon assigned a guy named Jim Bartko to being the liaison to Phil Knight, in part because they didn't want 50 different people on campus reaching out to Phil Knight. They thought it was better to kind of have one contact who had a deep relationship with him. And this, you know, Bartko ended up as the handler for Phil and Penny Knight, to the point where, like I've written about this, they go to a season-ending football banquet and Phil and Penny come through the door and Bartko looks up and sees them come through the door and his jaw drops because he wasn't expecting Penny to be at the banquet. This is like early 2000s football banquet. And so Bartko has to go running around the room talking to donors who he's already given gift baskets to, because he had gift baskets for all the wives, and has to apologize to somebody and say, hey, I'll send you a gift basket. So he takes the gift basket back and then re-gifts it to Penny, who's walked through the door. And that's, you know, that's the liaison's job. And Bartko did it very well at Oregon. Now they've got some different people handling the larger donors now at the University of Oregon. But it's true, like, you don't want a bunch of people with their hands out. But I also think she misses the point of the question. My question is not really, like, Oregon State, I don't think, should go to Jensen Huang and go, hey, do you like football? Get involved in the football hire. No, that's not it. I think they go to NVIDIA and they go, hey, we'd like to use AI in helping vet coaching candidates or helping make this decision. Could we create some kind of program in AI that would help us with those data points? And you get NVIDIA interested, invested in being a stakeholder and being part of the hire. Then could you go further? I mean, she talks about data points in sports. Sports is built for data. Could you go further? You know, I thought about Mario Cristobal over the weekend. He had kind of another misfire, coaching misfire. And Cristobal is at Miami, and, you know, he's had situational difficulty with calling plays or calling timeouts, or do I run a play? Do I take a knee? You know, he played for overtime, and it got him burned in overtime. Conservative guy. But I kind of wonder if, you know, we're headed towards a time when coaches up in the coaching box will have some AI help. And what do we call here? What's the play call? What's the situation? You talk about it being fast. You have the world's fastest supercomputer on campus at Oregon State. You shouldn't have it, you know, dormant on a Saturday night if there's a college football game going on. So what I'm saying is, like, you get NVIDIA interested in what you're doing with the football program, and maybe they find an interest in football that goes beyond that. I also asked Jayathi Murthy about Scott Barnes, the athletic director. A lot of people frustrated with Barnes. I know there are a lot of fans out there that would love to see Scott Barnes fired or pushed out of the way. And I think there's a couple things going on here with Scott Barnes, if we're being real. Number one is, we have to acknowledge he's done a tremendous amount of work with the Pac-12 conference and getting everything reconstituted and set back up. And you have to remember, too, Washington State's athletic director, Pat Chun, left for Washington. Washington State's president, Kirk Schultz, left. He retired. The football coaches at both schools, Jonathan Smith and Jake Dickert, took off. Jayathi Murthy and Scott Barnes, if they weren't around, I shudder at what might have happened to the Pac-12 conference. I think they did a lot of work alongside Teresa Gold to make sure that the conference stayed a conference. That said, the world has changed. And I think the frustrations that Oregon State fans are having with Barnes in some cases are justified, because he is an athletic director that comes from the old world, comes from old thinking. And while he was heavily distracted with the rebuild of the Pac-12 and his football coach Trent Bray was struggling, it's not lost on me that the dynamic changed. The fact that Barnes was, you know, told me he wasn't sure if they needed a general manager. You know, everybody who's working in a major college football program around the country is saying, yeah, you absolutely need a general manager. Oregon's got one. Oregon's got one of the highest paid GMs in the country. You know, Oregon State needs a GM, needs somebody to manage that roster, somebody to be looking out for the coach, working with the coach, negotiating with agents, having relationships, negotiating with players. So you don't end up in a situation like the Beavers ended up in on Saturday. Malik Murphy makes $1.5 million. You know, what'd he throw? 3 or 4 passes? You know, got Jabari Johnson, who was essentially your quarterback on Saturday. You know what Johnson's making? I'm told his NIL deal with Oregon State, his revenue share, whatever, is $50,000. that guy's getting the snaps. The $1.5 million quarterback is not. So you can't have that play out over and over and over again. That said, Barnes's contract runs through 2030. He's going to get to call his own shot, and he has the backing of his president. Listen for yourself. I asked her about her, you know, her belief in Scott Barnes here.
Look, I mean, clearly, you know, we hate to lose, right? I hate to lose. I mean, I hate to lose at anything. I mean, I hate to lose at tic-tac-toe, and you know, let alone football. So we're all very competitive, and losing doesn't feel good, and it doesn't feel good to him, and it doesn't feel good to me. But when I think about Scott and Scott's role, I got to tell you, I don't know that there's anybody else who could have done what he did these last couple of years. All right. And so what I'm looking for is really the long haul. You know, it's fine. We've got a season. We've been an enormous transition. We will figure this out. The real focus now is how do you build for the long haul? And when I look at what Scott did the last couple of years, I honestly don't know anybody else who can see us through, you know, this kind of building. So he's the right guy for the right moment.
I keep thinking back, you know, it's you and him at Oregon State, and the AD and the president at Washington State are both gone. There's been turnover. The coaches, both football coaches are gone.
Yeah.
How much rolling up of the sleeves was Scott Barnes doing as you are in the rebuild?
Oh my gosh. All the time. I mean, think about, you know, what we did, right? What he did. You know, we've got not just an uproar in athletics here at OSU. Pac-12 has fallen apart, all right? And Pac-12's funding has disappeared. Pac-12 has to be literally pulled apart. They go from 150 people to 30 people. Yeah. We've got to get a new commissioner. I mean, there was a time when Scott and Washington State's AD were literally the people who were helping out Pac-12 go through this entire transition. So it wasn't just our athletic departments. And all the dimensions that I mentioned, I mean, legislative, alumni, student relations, government relations, everybody was doing these things. So people think it's just about winning this or that football game. It's much, much more than that.
If you're somebody holding out hope that Jayathi Murthy is going to fire Scott Barnes, don't hold your breath. She went on to say later in the interview that he has her back, she has his back. They are working in lockstep, and I think a lot of their bond comes from the Pac-12 part. But I don't disagree with Beaver fans who are frustrated, who say, hey, this job's changed. Is Barnes right for it? And I think the hope that you have if you're an Oregon State fan is that he either wakes up to that reality in the short term, or he makes his mind up that, you know, he's 63 years old, he's had some health issues. Maybe he makes his mind up that it's, you know, you go be a fundraiser, you go be an advisor to the athletic department, and you sit with Ed Ray at football games in the stands, and you have an easier life. I mean, Scott Barnes could come to that realization. If you want to hear the rest of the interview, you can find it on YouTube. Just search for John Canzano. All right, coming up, our big splash, the one thing that you need to know in sports. Stick around. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
It happened again. You didn't have to wait very long for it, but it happened again. It's not another gambling issue in the NBA. It's not irregularities in the NFL. It's not Major League Baseball. It isn't a league suspending and fining players. It's not a poker game. It wasn't the FBI or the Department of Justice. This one, the big splash today, comes out of the UFC. UFC fighter Isaac Dulgarian has been released from the roster 2 days after sportsbooks flagged unusual betting interest against the featherweight ahead of his first round loss on Saturday. There's a entity called Integrity Compliance 360. It's a firm that monitors the betting market for abnormal activity. The FanDuel, DraftKings, casinos, they all sort of contract with this Integrity Compliance entity. It alerted its clients about the unusual interest in this fight involving Dulgarian. It was on the fight night undercard, ended in the first round. the UFC, a spokesperson telling reporters that the UFC works with Integrity Service to monitor this, and their betting partner conducted a review. They take the allegations seriously. Dolgarian was a heavy favorite in his bout against Yadier Devalle. He was a minus 250 favorite going into this fight. Devalle was a plus 200 underdog, so he was a 2-1 underdog beginning on Saturday. But the price started to drop in the hours leading to the fight. Multiple sports books say that large bets came in on the underdog ahead of the fight. Bettors continued to bet heavily on the underdog even after the odds had moved to a less advantageous price. That's another red flag. Some of the sports books halted wagering on the bout Saturday afternoon. Caesars Sportsbook posted on Saturday night that it would refund the bets that were made on Dolgarian. Dolgarian has been released by the UFC. It's the latest black eye, so to speak, involving gambling and sports. We got to talk about this. Can we go back to 1918, though, to start to have this conversation? I was telling someone this morning about the Black Sox scandal, the 1919 Black Sox and the World Series that changed baseball. Shoeless Joe Jackson, the movie Eight Men Out. You talk about, you know, gambling, and we talk about gambling and sports like it's a modern problem. It really isn't. Historically, there have been problems over the years in boxing and other sports. Wherever there's money, wherever there's gambling, there's potential for fraud, and there's the potential for gamblers to get involved and get an angle on a fighter. Or in the case of the 1919 Black Sox, the 1918 World Series, this was about multiple players on the Black Sox team, and it really was a problem for baseball. And baseball brought in Kennesaw Mountain Landis, a judge who came in to fix it. But the White Sox were accused of intentionally losing the 1919 World Series against the Reds. There was a gambling syndicate that was led by Arnold Rothstein, possibly led by Rothstein, this organized crime. But Landis ended up banning all eight implicated players from professional baseball. The Baseball Hall of Fame, for a long time carried this distinction. Rob Manfred reinstated the Black Sox and several other now deceased players in 2025. But, you know, Charles Comiskey was the owner of the White Sox. He was widely resented by his players because he was cheap. And Comiskey had taken part in the Players League labor rebellion in like the late 1890s, 1895, 1897. He long had a reputation for underpaying his players. White Sox were one of the best teams in baseball. They won the 1917 World Series. And because of baseball's contracts at that time, any player who refused to accept a contract was prohibited for playing for any other team. Like they could only change teams with permission from their current team. They had no union. They had no bargaining power. And Comiskey was probably the worst of an ownership group that was pretty bad at the time. The White Sox had the biggest payroll in baseball in 1919, but it was pennies on the dollar. And the White Sox had, you know, Eddie Collins at second base, who was educated. He had gone to Columbia University. They had Red Farber and Dickie Kerr and Ray Schalk. These were all college-educated players. And the fact of the matter is, I think they were probably galvanized by the fact that they were underpaid. And, you know, they had a reason to be mad at their employer. And there is nothing like a scorned employee, right? So, you know, Chick Gandel, White Sox player, apparently met with a Boston bookmaker in a hotel near Fenway Park in September of 1919, and they discussed the plans to possibly throw the upcoming series against the Cincinnati Reds. They were paid $80,000, okay? So a bunch of players, apparently a couple days later, met and listened to a proposal from the gamblers in Gandel's room at the Ansonia Hotel in New York City. Buck Weaver, the team's third baseman, attended the meeting, did not take money, still got banned, along with the seven other Black Sox, for knowing about the fix. But the scheme got, you know, a lot of attention. And you know, the World Series, people can debate what happened. And Shoeless Joe Jackson, obviously banned from baseball, implicated in the scheme, played really well in that World Series. He professed his innocence until the end of his life. Other players admitted that, you know, they did take money, but Joe Jackson hit 375 in the World Series. He hit the only home run in the World Series. He threw out five base runners. He had no errors in the field. And so, you know, he was still implicated in this thing. And the aftermath of that was, you know, baseball bringing in Kennesaw Mountain Landis to clean up baseball. They brought in a judge. I kind of wondered in the aftermath, or maybe if we ever get to the aftermath of this NBA scandal, and with what we know about Ippei Muzuhara in Major League Baseball and the Shohei Ohtani thing, I'm kind of left wondering if what professional sports needs is some kind of umbrella entity over the top that has really nothing to do with gambling, but everything to do with gambling. What I mean is the casinos have these agencies that are out there looking for irregularities. Is it possible that the big sports, college football, NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, they need some sort of umbrella entity over the top that protects them, that advises them, that works with educating players, that works with really drilling down on focusing on not allowing gamblers to get to the players themselves? I talked to a Division I basketball coach in the ACC yesterday, last night on the phone. He called me and just called to check in. And our conversation turned towards the Chauncey Billups situation. And this person told me, I have no words. I have no words for what is going on with Chauncey Billups. Can't believe it. It's dumber than dumb. Why would he ever get involved? You know, no words, but a lot of words. And I asked the person, I asked the coach, I said, what do you tell your players? Because it's easier than ever right now for people on the outside to get to players. You can DM a player. You can on Instagram. You can DM a player on Twitter. You can reach out and get to these players on their college campuses. You know, it used to be that there was an insulation or a level of insulation. I've heard NBA players, former NBA players, talk about this, like, hey, in the 70s and 80s and 90s and early 2000s, it was hard to get to players because they were largely insulated from the public. It's not that hard anymore with social media. It's one of the things that social media has done. And so you have these contact points that are frequent and easy. You've got some people with bad intentions. You've got some other people there that may have an affinity for gambling and the competition that it brings. You have the potential here for players at all levels to, the White Sox were mad in 1919 about being underpaid, but I don't know if that's the situation here in 2025. I think it's more likely in 2025 you just have some people that potentially are moving in circles where they get in debt to, you know, the mafia or the mob or a bookmaker because they get upside down on their wagers. And then suddenly they're saying, hey, look, I'll forgive your wagers if you share information. But I asked the college coach, I said, what do you tell your guys? How do you instruct your players? Like when people reach out and they're trying to gain gambling information, and the coach said he had to get off social media because he was getting contacted after games with people who were irate that he ruined their two-team or their three-team parlay with a substitution or messed up their over-under bet. You know, there are a lot of entities that just focus on the prop bets. And he said, I had to get out of there. He said, it was insane. And so I said, what do you tell your players? What do you tell your players when they're contacted by people, even casually, who will ask them, how you feeling about the game coming up? How are you guys looking? Who's healthy? Anybody not going to play? How do you instruct your players? And he said that they literally had a meeting in the wake of the Chauncey Billups NBA thing where they said, okay, here's what's going on out there. Here's people that are trying to potentially get to you to get inside information. We don't want to be party to that. We don't want to play that game. And so he told his players, when they are asked how things are going or who's healthy, to just say, we're okay. We're okay is the standard response that they're going to give, because they don't want to give any insight. They don't want the perception that they're giving away inside information. They don't want to play the game. I find it fascinating that college coaches are tuned into this. I find it mind-blowing that the NBA is going to potentially want to, at some point here, have us believe that only Chauncey Billups and Terry Rozier and Damon Jones. It's just, you know, it's not Tim Donaghy as the officials, as they told us years ago. Oh, it's a lone guy. This is just a one person thing. It's an isolated incident. Like baseball told us with Ippei Muzuhara. Does anybody really believe that Major League Baseball players in the clubhouse across the leagues aren't placing illegal wagers or playing in poker games. Does anybody really believe that NFL players aren't doing things on the side or talking to somebody? I think you have a can of worms. You have a Pandora's box. You have the tip of the iceberg. Use whatever metaphor that you want. But the more I think about the gambling issue and this latest FBI investigation in the Department of Justice, the more I unpack that, the more I believe that there is so much there that it could require the type of oversight that Major League Baseball had in 1919, where they brought in a federal judge, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, to clean up baseball and send a message. I wonder if you need an entity like that over the top of all of sports that is designed to protect the players and insulate the players from the potential harm that could come from outside influence. Tip of the iceberg, you better believe it. I think there's much more there for the NBA. I think it's going to be really problematic. The fact that Terry Rozier essentially got shut down without getting shut down tells me that the NBA knew something was off. Now you've got a coach in Chauncey Billups, former player in Damon Jones. You've got the crime families of New York involved. Didn't even know there were crime families in New York anymore. All of this not looking good for the NBA and not boding well for sports in general. So the latest is the UFC fighter. This is not going to stop. It's going to continue until the sports entities get together and figure out how they draw some boundaries, some healthy boundaries when it comes to sports gambling.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
My kids are really good at spotting fakes. They know a fake person when they see one. They know a AI-generated social media post when they see one. The rest of us, iffy. We're a little bit iffy on this stuff. Grown-ups. A tweet on Twitter about a verbal altercation between St. Bonaventure general manager Adrian Wojnarowski and officials who were officiating the game. Somebody tweeted out as a joke that there was a heated verbal altercation between the officiating crew and Woj, and that Woj was ejected from the venue. Did you see this, Stephen? You see the story?
I did see the story, yeah. I saw the tweet, and I wondered the same thing. You know, I don't know if it's real or not. It sounded too fake to me. And so
it's fake.
Yeah.
It turns out it's fake.
And so I had to go and look up the guy and, like, look at his profile and see what it is. And then you just see, yeah, he's just trying to get some interaction with his profile and people clicking on him.
What should we do? Should we block that guy? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I kind of think so.
But people are doing this more and more. And then you see, like, the fake Ian Rappaport tweets and... I don't know what to believe now when I see a video that, you know, most of the, there's these great videos and it's unbelievable and you're like, oh, it's fake.
My whole thing is like, what did these people get out of this?
I don't know. 2 minutes, 10 seconds of fame?
Like
15 seconds of fame?
Like,
what is it?
Exactly. Like NBA Twitter has NBA Centel instead of Central and they are super popular with just the satire tweets. And they have a huge following. I don't understand like what the point is of it. I don't get the appeal. I don't think it's that funny. Like I don't think it's that creative. It just is. What they do is they act so professional. And then like ESPN picks them up, and that's where they think it's really funny. I guess that's what they get out of it.
They're tricking everybody. I don't understand too, because I feel like if you have that kind of creative bent, you should be going and using that for good.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Be able to.
You know what I mean? Go use that superpower for good. It's like these, you know, the mastermind criminals. Like I see these guys on social media that'll talk about how they wrote bad checks and they stayed in front of the law, and then but they went to prison for like 15 years, and now they're on you know TikTok or Instagram. And they're telling their story, and I'm like, why didn't you just use all that smarts for good? Take that superpower, Lex Luthor, and use it for good. You could have been, you know, you could have been a tech guru. Why did you have to have the lair? Why did you have to have the stigma of being the villain? Why did you do that? I don't love these stories, and I saw it, and I thought it was fake. But I saw a video last night. I was the kids at bedtime. I happened to be on TikTok, and the kids were all tucked in, and I always go in and I say goodnight to them. And do you need a glass of water? Do you need a foot rub? Do you need, you know, what do you want to talk about? There's always something. And so the 9-year-old was like, I was walking in. I had my phone out. And she goes, what are you looking at? I said, well, I saw this video. I was trying to figure out if it was real. And she goes, let me see it. And it was a video taken presumably on Halloween of two kids who were trick-or-treating. And they're coming up to the door to ring the doorbell and say trick-or-treat. And they've got their full bags of candy. And on the porch is like some giant skeleton ghost-looking horror film-looking creature who's standing there. And then right when they go to ring the doorbell, the thing moves. Presumably it's a person who's just standing really still when they're there. And the kids get so scared that they bump into each other. Their candy goes flying. The door opens up, and then both kids are on the ground and like horrified, and the candy's everywhere. The kids are trying to scoop up the candy and run away. And I watched it like 10 times because it was really funny. It was funny to watch kids get scared. But the nine-year-old saw it once and went, oh, that's a fake, Dad. You can tell. And she pointed to like this one area of the camera that was blurry, one area of the film that was blurry. And then they moved on. But she knew it immediately. And then the 11-year-old was like calling from her room, let me see that. And I go and show her. And she goes, oh, yeah, that's a fake. That's a fake. You have to know. These kids, they can spot a fake a mile away. We're not as good at that. And I kind of, like, I've been talking a lot about AI. You heard me in that last hour talk to Jayathi Murthy, the president at Oregon State. I was trying to tell her, like, hey, use AI with your sports programs. And the other thing is, though, I'm a little scared. Like, what if Oregon State did that? What if Oregon State became the AI school when it came to college athletics? What if they let, you know, ChatGPT or the equivalent with that supercomputer that they're going to have on campus involve itself in game planning? What if they let it involve itself in scouting players? You know, Malik Murphy, as I said last hour, quarterback Malik Murphy. Steven, we know he's making $1.5 million. I found out over the weekend Jabari Johnson's making $50,000. Can you wrap your head around that? Like, one guy's making $1.5 million. He threw three passes. The other guy's getting $50,000, and he has kind of become the starting quarterback at Oregon State. How do you rectify that in your mind if you're Oregon State? Like, that's a lot of wasted money that you could be, like, for $1.5 million, you could have put that into a bunch of offensive linemen, a pass rusher, a defensive back. You know how much better could they be if they had allocated those resources better? And what if using AI is the way to do that? Like, here's how you allocate your roster. You don't need to spend a bunch of time. Here's how much money you should be spending at every position. And you go out and get the best player you can get for that amount of money at each position. Is that the future of college athletics? I don't know. Does that scare you at all, or are you okay with it?
I'm okay with it. If it works, John, it turns into a movie like Moneyball, and you are Billy Bean and the A's, where you're trying to make a move and they're doing something different. And I think that's kind of the upside of it. Now, the downside could be no one's tried it before, so it may not work. It may not work into sports, because sports, yes, is very analytical, very stat-driven in all of these sports, but there is still a human element to sports, whether it's officiating, whether it's, you know, coaching or playing. There is still that human element that, as your kids can notice, AI still can't capture all of the human element yet. And so you're still going to be a little bit behind in that situation. But it doesn't scare me. If I'm Oregon State, yeah, I'm shooting for it. And you asked about the Malik Murphy. Can you wrap your head around him making that and the Jabari Johnson making $50,000, Malik Murphy making $1.5 million? I can, because you know why? It's professional sports. And sometimes you overpay a guy that doesn't perform very well. And that's my problem with this. I have a hard time wrapping my head around Jabari Johnson making $50,000.
I know.
Like, that's the crazier part to me, is that the backup quarterback is making $50,000 at Oregon State. Like, not that it's ruining the game of college football and college basketball, that these guys are making so much money already, but it kind of ruins the game a little bit to me. It's all professional money now. Like, you're making $1.5 million.
Can you imagine the comparable player at Oregon, what that guy's getting? What's the backup QB at Oregon getting?
Like 10x?
It has to be $1 million, right? It has to be.
At least 10x, then.
Yeah. Trent Walker, the wide receiver at Oregon State, I'm told by sources he's getting about 250. And Malik Murphy's getting $1.5 million.
So, like, DeCorian Moore, $2.5 million?
He's got to be over $1 million. John Mateer, I found this out, too. John Mateer, because I was talking to Washington State boosters on the sideline at the Pac-2 championship game, some people heavily involved with the Cougar Collective. And I was like, hey, tell me how the Mateer thing went down. And they were like, we were trying to scrape together every penny. We were using every resource, every small business. Hey, can you, the coffee company, the beer, the wine, Double Back Winery, Drew Bledsoe's Winery, like, you know, how much can you put in? How much can you put in? Like, how, you know, what kind of package can we put together? They got to $1.2 million for Mateer, okay? So they go to John Mateer, and they present him with this offer of $1.2 million. And then the pitch along with that is, you're going to matter here at Washington State in a way you could never matter at Oklahoma. If you falter at Oklahoma, they're going to recruit right over the top of you. You may not even play, right? So you don't know. Nothing was guaranteed for John Mateer going to Oklahoma. But you could really matter at Washington State. You know, you could go down as Ryan Leaf or Drew Bledsoe if you stick around. They got their $1.2 million, and they presented to Mateer. And then they later got a call from Mateer, and it was a very apologetic call. And they said, well, how much did Oklahoma offer you? Steven, I hope you're sitting down. $3.4 million is what John Mateer got to leave Washington State to go to Oklahoma. He got $3.4 million. I just think it's not even a conversation. It's not even a conversation. And so it makes it very hard. And I said, what did you say to Mateer? And they said, we wish you well. Like, they knew. Like
what else can you say? You can't say
what else can you say? Yeah. That's it. I just think we got to wrap our heads around this and we got to figure this stuff out. But I just think AI could be an angle where Oregon State, you go, okay, you should only be paying your quarterback $750,000. All right, you better spend well, but that's $750,000 is the number.
Well, don't you think they have that in professional football and baseball? Yeah,
they have a guy. I don't know if they're using AI, but I'm sure they have a chart. And the problem is, in professional football, though, it changes because, you know, when the quarterback gets off his rookie contract, you go from making a guy making 900,000 to a guy making, you know, 50 million, Brock Purdy. The 49ers are, you know, having to pay Brock Purdy. And I was, you know, he was a guy who was making $600,000 a year ago. So I think you have to figure this stuff out for yourself. If you're a school like Oregon State, the margins are very thin. You can still, I think, matter in your world, but you better spend well. You can't afford to have a guy making 1.5 throwing four passes in a game.
I agree. And I think of a guy like Jaron Kiave Sagapuulateli down at Cal. Like, he's a really good player as a true freshman. They've kind of middled out a little bit here going on in the season, but he's a guy going forward that you need to keep. But you know, every school in the nation is going to be like, hey, come to our school. Here's, you know, $2.5 million. Here's $3.4 million, like John Mateer money. And if I'm JKS, I'm asking for that. Now, what does Cal do in that situation? Can they pony up and, you know, can they get to that number, or do they want to, you know, allocate that money to every position and improve their team, or kind of go all in with the one guy? I think it's tough for these, you know, for these schools that just don't have the unlimited money that they can say, look, you know, Oklahoma can write a check for $3.4 million. Cal just can't do that right now.
You have to play Moneyball. There's no, you know, and it's like the Mariners. Like, you don't have, you know, you don't have the bottom payroll in the league. You got about the 15th or 17th highest payroll in Major League Baseball. It just means you can't have a bunch of guys get hurt. You can't make mistakes. The Dodgers can afford some mistakes. Why? Because their 9-hitter can win them a World Series. You know, and their 8-hitter can really play. And they're just little better, little deeper. And, you know, they can bring a guy in as a defensive replacement in center field. It just makes a great play. And, you know, it's like you make the manager look really smart when you got guys that you can bring in that make that kind of difference. But I think Oregon State, like when I heard that on Saturday, Malik Murphy at $1.5 million and Jabari Johnson at $50,000. And I look at the stat sheet and I'm like, that's a lot of money standing on the sideline holding the clipboard.
Is it okay for Oregon State fans to criticize Malik Murphy then because he's making money?
It is. It's, you know, the other guy that I was talking to on the sideline at the game, you know, because, you know, it's Oregon State and Washington State and they're playing this game. And, you know, I'm looking over at Washington State. And I walked over and Alex Brink, the former Washington State quarterback, is, you know, working as a broadcaster. You know, he says, hey, John, how are you doing? You know, and I said, how are you handling that? This is a Sheldon High School kid, right? He's got connections in the state of Oregon. I said, how do you handle that when guys are making money and the criticism on air, off air? And he's like, hey, they're pros. These are pros now. Like, you know,
you're making money. And the and last night I mentioned that ACC basketball coach who called me. He was saying these guys are in their own head so much now. They're young, they have money, and they're acting like, you know, they want to be treated like kids sometimes, and they want to be treated like professionals other times. And he says one of the conversations he's had to have with his players is, hey, you're a pro now. You're a professional. This is a, you know, this is, you know, you're making money. This isn't about you coming to school and, you know, college learning experience and, you know, get it. No, you are a professional. Get yourself to practice and act like a pro.
And this is my problem with the NCAA, John, is they're afraid to take a stand on anything. We've talked about, you know, some of the G League guys going back to school now after being literal professionals and playing summer league NBA and going back to college. The NCAA does have leverage in this situation. The NCAA can elevate you going forward. I look at college basketball especially, and this is the instance I always bring up is Zion. When Zion went to Duke, he wasn't the overall number one pick. That's not what he was thought of as being. He was a top 10 guy. He was a top 5 guy, but nobody knew exactly what he was. He goes to Duke, plays on ESPN every single game, has all these dunks. He is the surefire number one overall pick in the draft. Duke elevated his stock. The NCAA elevated his stock. Had he gone to the G League, had he gone straight from high school to the pros, he's probably not the number one overall pick. He's just not. That's not what he was, because he was 6'5" and a little overweight, and nobody knew exactly what he was. But he goes to Duke, gets on national TV, gets all these dunks, gets all these, you know, he blows his shoe out, and now he's this number one overall pick that is a surefire prospect. The NCAA does hold leverage and can elevate you as a, you know, these players if they want to get to the next level, but they're so afraid of anything that they will not stand on anything at all. And this is a problem. And I think this is why the NCAA is going to go down at some point and just be, you know, it's going to be the Oregon football club taking on, you know, the Iowa football club in a Big Ten matchup. And, you know, next week at Kinnick Stadium, it's not going to be the University of Oregon versus the University of Iowa. It's just going to be these club teams that are basically minor league systems for the NFL.
Well, if you look at like the aerial photographs of these campuses, that you see like the library and the administration building, and then on the other side you see the football stadium and the basketball arena, and everything in between, it looks really small. Like it's just all this small stuff. And I think we already have that literally at the University of Oregon. There's like this division between the campus and the athletic facilities, and I think you have that theoretically at other places. You also have the criticisms. These coaches are all getting fired. And there's quick triggers there. I think the players are held to a standard that is higher than ever. Of course, we have gambling that has now become this big issue. But Mario Cristobal, is, you know, look at what happened to Mario Cristobal over the weekend. We all know Mario Cristobal can really coach, but he doesn't really have kind of the X's and the O's. He's not like he gets the Jimmies and the Joes.
He can recruit.
He can recruit. He can win these games he should win. But he gets into a overtime situation or a late game situation against, you know, SMU, and he laid up, man. He has one of the best kickers in the country, and he laid up and played for overtime, and it killed him. And I've seen Cristobal do this so many times that I've lost count of how many times he's lost games that he should win. The national pundits are just killing him today. Here's Paul Feinbaum.
I mean, the Miami loss was just inexcusable. I realize SMU is a good team, but it's getting hard to watch this Miami program every year almost do something.
Aaron Taylor on CBS Sports, he thought the defense at Miami quit.
That defense quit in overtime.
Yes.
Really? SMU had -2 rushing yards in regulation, but when it came to overtime, when it mattered, their first rush was 5 yards. They followed it up by another 5 rushes for 25 yards. So they had 6 rushes for 25 yards and a touchdown. After they stopped Miami, when SMU needed to win, they relied on a run game that wasn't there, and they found a way to win. And BJ, you and I were talking, watching Miami, when they missed and didn't get those points there at the end, they quit. They settled down and quit. They were not trying to get the ball out, and that to me is as big of an indictment as the results of the game.
I agree with him. They quit. I think that what he was really trying to say is like they just broke. Because they realized when Carson Beck threw the interception and they didn't have the points, they were hosed. And I think they just kind of rolled over and went, all right, doesn't matter if we lose by a field goal or a touchdown. But I also think we're all stuck with this old way of thinking where when a team loses a game, they're done, they're out. The rankings, of course, are coming out tomorrow night, and Miami's going to be penalized. They're going to be penalized by the playoff committee. But you know, the best teams in the NFL sometimes lose 5, 6, 7 games in a season. And I think we're going to see more of this. I think we're going to see teams that, you know, there's a leveling that has gone on within the Power Four where it's not like it used to be. Like LSU's not LSU anymore. Auburn's not Auburn anymore. You know, Vanderbilt can win. SMU can play with Miami.
But is that like, what you want, John? Do you want the NFL light in college football where you lose 3 games and you're fine?
I don't. And I think the standard needs to be held high. I think the most number of games you should be able to lose and make the playoff is 2. I just don't want to see a bunch of 9-3s in there. I think it's too big if you're getting 3 lost teams in there. But we're going to find out tomorrow. We'll talk about the rankings coming up. Plus, we'll play Punch It Audio. Stick around for that. You got the BF.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Steven, we got a big Monday Night Football game coming up. What'd you think of the World Series? Were you happy about the World Series?
I was happy in that it was a really exciting World Series. That was Game 7. I can't root for the Dodgers in good faith, knowing that they outspent on everybody. Their top 3 hitters make more than the entire Blue Jays lineup. Like, I can't cheer for that, but I mean, what a game that was, that Game 7. And the Blue Jays, you talk about a game of inches, man. So close, right? Bases loaded. Rojas makes the play from his backside to get him out at home with Will Smith. You know, his one cleat hanging off the catcher's off home plate right there. Maybe if you know, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a bigger lead, he scores and the Blue Jays win the World Series. Andy Pahe's just railroading Kiki Hernandez out in left field to make that catch, which was an incredible catch. I mean, so it was a great game, but I can't be like psyched that the Dodgers won. Like I just can't be that guy.
I'm not psyched for the Dodgers. I'll defend the base runner on third base a little bit. It's a situational play there. You know, that ball was hit pretty hard to second base and he gets thrown out by an inch. You don't want to be so far off the base that you get doubled up on a line drive to the third baseman. So it's, you know, could he have had another half a step or a step? Probably. Would that have made the difference? Probably. But I understand what he was thinking there. You know, he was thinking, you know, ball hit, you know, anywhere he's going, but you gotta not get doubled up on third base. That would have been a disaster as well.
The only other problem that I had was in the 9th inning on the Rojas home run, 3-2 count. Like, yes, you cannot walk him, but he threw the hanger. He threw a slider at him. I just would have loved to try to throw a heat at him, make him hit that. But again, it's just one of those things where you're feeling comfortable with your slider, you're throwing the off-speed pitch, and it just didn't work. He hung that down the middle. But I'm just not a fan of, in that situation against the 9 hitter, to have that type of risk instead of just throwing the 96, 97 mile per hour fastball right down their throat.
I think you obviously want to make a better pitch there. I also think Shohei Ohtani's coming up next. You don't want to walk that guy. And so I think that was on the pitcher's mind.
But he hadn't really done anything since what, Game 4?
I know, but I'm facing the 9 hitter. I'm throwing the ball in the zone. I this guy's got a swing. I'm not letting Shohei Ohtani beat me. And you saw what the Blue Jays did with Ohtani. They essentially pitched around him outside of the balls he hit, you know, out of the park. They pitched around him and just put him on base. Well, so
the Pajes catch, John, in the center fielder when he railroaded Kike, was that the right play, or should he have kind of let off?
No, he made the right play. That's a tough play for the left fielder. That ball hit over your head as a left fielder. You're running like Willie Mays there. You're catching the ball. The center fielder's got a better angle. I think it was interesting because they just, you know, Dave Roberts subbed him into the game. Pajes comes into the game just, you know, what, a few pitches before that.
Right, yeah.
It looks like it's such a great move, and I thought about that when the ball was hit, because that's a tough thing for an outfielder to do, to come in a defensive situation in a Game 7 of a World Series in the late innings, and you know, you got it, you know, your job is to go out and make plays. So I loved the aggression with which Pajes went after the ball. I said it earlier, he looked like Kelly Leak in the Bad News Bears going and stealing the ball from the left fielder, but it's the right play. If you can make that play, you catch that ball, and he's coming over. The one problem I had with it was maybe there was lack of communication. if I'm the center fielder, I gotta let the left fielder know I'm coming. And I don't know if he did or if it was so loud with the crowd out there that he couldn't hear. But, you know, you almost have this collision. You almost have the World Series ending on a bang-bang play at the plate where, you know, is he safe? And then you almost have it ending on a collision in the outfield and a ball hit to the, you know, deep to the warning track.
You're two outs away in the top of the ninth when Real hits the homer.
Yeah, you're two outs away. There's so many moments there where the Blue Jays could have won it. And for a Game 7, like sometimes we've seen those Game 7 do-or-die situations not deliver. This one kind of delivered. It was a big game, a lot of back and forth. And if you just tuned in the ninth inning, that was enough. You know, all you saw was the ninth inning. That was enough for you to be like, wow, this was a really good finish to a good series. And the Dodgers win it. I don't like that part of it. America won. I liked that part of it. It was highly entertaining. I liked it. But to my point in the early part of the show, Stephen, I feel like all of these sporting events, NFL games, baseball games, college football games, we're getting more and more and more award and score games. They all start to feel like they're manipulated for television, for entertainment. Are you picking any of that up?
I heard you say it, and I heard you say it again right now, but what are you trying to get at? Are you trying to get at that they're...
Not rigged, but...
They're pushing some of
the,
this?
I think some of the things that they're doing, like the NFL... The NFL gets close games because they foster every rule change they can get that gives the offenses a chance to stay in the game. And then they have a hard salary cap and, you know, the way they schedule and the way that you, you draft in inverse order. Everything is geared towards everybody being equal. And so I think you do get a lot of one-score games. It wasn't this way. You have more one-score games in the NFL now than at any point in history. And I think that's because the NFL wants close games for great TV ratings. So I think it helps. I also think they want every team to feel like they have a chance. That helps too. I kind of felt in watching the baseball postseason, there were so many games. These teams are all so even that I think the Mariners, you put the Mariners in the World Series, they might win it. Like I was watching the Blue Jays and I'm like, gosh, the Blue Jays and Mariners were so close themselves. They go to a Game 7. And the Blue Jays are in another Game 7. And then you go back to the Game 5 in the American League Division Series. It felt like every single series that I really paid attention to came down to a last inning, last pitch, who's going to win situation. It feels like the NFL. And so I just kind of wonder if baseball's rule changes, pitch clock, the strike zones, just the way that these teams are constructed now. Of course, the Blue Jays, it's not like they were last in payroll. You had two teams in the top 10 in payroll playing out there. They're building everything to kind of be like dramatic and even and interesting.
I can buy that. And to your point, the Blue Jays going into the season, not like they were like the top team in the American League. Like they were maybe third or fourth in the AL East. You look at that division. So yeah, I mean, you look at any team. I think if you can catch lightning in a bottle, for the most part, you have a chance. I think in the NBA, there's really only a handful of teams that can win the NBA championship. I do wonder that in the NFL. Like, are we just overlooking everything and saying it's so, there's so many really good teams and really it's the Eagles and the Chiefs. Even the Chiefs lose to the Bills last night. But, like, are those the two teams that are just going to eventually play in the Super Bowl again? I don't know. Same with college football. We talk about how it's, it's very even all across the board. Are we just going to get, the same old, Ohio State versus Alabama versus Georgia or something like that in the national championship? I kind of think so. So I think it's not that it's, not that everybody can't feel like they have a chance. I do still feel like there is the cream of the crop, the elite of the elites that are still getting there. Dodgers are definitely in that category.
We're going to see, though, in college sports, I think some of the brand names aren't going to be where they used to be.
Like college basketball last year was all one season, the Final Four.
Yeah. And I think you'll be able to, with the Final Four in the playoff, you'll be able to look at budget and you'll be able to go, well, of course, okay, these are the top four budgets in college football right now. So, but I think getting to the playoff, like there was a lot of talk at this Oregon State Washington State game on Saturday on the sideline with donors and boosters on both sides. They were all saying, like, that Oregon State and Washington State feel like they can get to the playoff with the kind of frequency that, like, the fifth or sixth best team in, like, the Power Four conferences can get to the playoff. And so a great example of that is going to be, like, Washington against Washington State. Let's look back six, 7 years from now. and see, did Washington get to the playoff more frequently than Washington State or vice versa? What would your bet be on that? Can Washington State win the New World Pac-12 a couple of times in the next 6 years or once? Can they get to the playoff? Will Washington ever get to the playoff in the Big Ten? That I have that question. What do you think happens there?
That is a really good question. I would still pick Washington over Washington State. I think that's just more because I believe in Washington and what they do and how much money they do put involved. Like this year, they are 24th in the AP. If they win their next four, they're 10-2. They have a legitimate argument to be in the college football playoff. So can you win 10 games in the Big Ten? I think that's more likely than Washington State being able to win the Pac-12, be 11-1 probably on the season. Like if you're 10-2 and win the Pac-12, yeah, you still probably aren't going to get in. Like an American team will probably get in over that. Maybe a Sun Belt. And like someone else still has a good chance to do that. So you have to go 11-1, win the Pac-12. I kind of think Washington winning 10 games is more likely going to get it in that way than Washington State.
If Jed Fish stays, if he doesn't, you're starting over again. You have to deal with the reality at Washington that I think Washington can get there in a decade. I think Washington can get there if they're taking the top. How many times can Washington finish in the top four in the Big Ten in a decade? I think one or two times. But I think Washington State in a decade could probably get to the top of the New World Pac-12 one or two times. That could happen.
But that, my argument would be, my counterpoint would be, do you think the Pac-12 is going to be that much better than the American? Because the American seems like they're head and shoulders above everybody this season.
Yeah.
Because Boise's a little down. Do you think that the American and the Pac-12 are not that close? Or you think Pac-12 is way ahead or whatever it is?
I think the Pac-12's top to bottom better. Like I think in most years you're going to see Boise State or San Diego State at the top right now. And then I think the bottom of the Pac-12, the New World Pac-12, will still have teams like Texas State, Utah State, Colorado State, right now. That's who would be at the bottom. I think you would take the Pac-12 head-to-head if you played 1-8 and said, all right, we're going to cross over and play your best eight teams. I think the Pac-12 probably wins six of those. But I think what you have to worry about is just the top of the American. You have to worry about Memphis. You have to worry about Tulane. In a given year, Army or somebody like that having a great year. But I think the Pac-12 is going to end up looking like it's the better top-to-bottom conference. The question I have, and it's a question I addressed today in the Monday mailbag, is what do they do in 2026? Because whatever they do in 2026 might not happen for 27. The Pac-12 in 2026 has got eight members. That's seven conference games. So there's this all this talk about, hey, how do they get an eighth game? Do they play a crossover series with the Sun Belt or Conference USA? Does that necessarily help them? Do they do a home and home like Washington State and Oregon State are doing this year? Does that help them? What happens if you do a home and home and then, Boise State and San Diego State play twice and then they play a third time? And, nobody wants to see a third game. So there's a lot of questions about what they're going to do in 2026. They have to figure that out. But I kind of think the Pac-12 will end up being the better conference. And, but it's not doesn't mean they're going to go to the playoff and win a game.
Right.
But it means that your conference champion probably gets to the playoff. Tomorrow we're going to get the reveal. We'll talk about the reveal coming up. Plus, we'll play some Punch It audio. I want you to leave it here. You got the BFT.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I got to be honest. Halloween, I liked you. I liked you when you were here. I'm not so sure I like Halloween, the aftermath of Halloween. There's some cleanup involved, with the Halloween decor. Some people out there have already pivoted into Christmas. I don't know if you know any of these people that have pivoted into Christmas. I think technically you need to wait till Thanksgiving happens to do Christmas. I think if you are driving around with a Christmas tree on top of your car before you are carving a turkey or eating cranberry and stuffing, you are out of line. You are out of pocket on that. I also have a complicated relationship with leftover Halloween candy. We did full-size candy bars, which is a problem for me because now I've got a bunch of full-size Snicker bars and peanut M&Ms.
I'll be right over.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? This is like, I'm not kidding you. I went to the gym today and I was like, part of the reason I'm in the gym. By the way, I texted Dan Lanning when I was in the gym, and I said to Dan Lanning, What are you doing for your workouts? Because I got to think, like, Oregon's got this strength and conditioning coach. If you're the coach at Oregon, you would have access to, like, the best, you know, workout strength and conditioning coach in the country, you know, and you'd lean on that. And I said to Lanning, I said, what are you doing right now? I said, my gym workout is the same workout since 1995. And he says, and I took this as very flattering, because I consider myself, do you consider me older or the same age as Dan Lanning?
Older.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
He says, at our age, like we're the same age. He says, it's more about the reps and less about the weight. He said, on that note, I'm the last guy to ask. My in-season workout includes coffee and Zen after I brush my teeth until I fall asleep. What's this Zen thing?
It's, I don't know.
Is it like a tobacco replacement thing?
Yeah, it's a tobacco replacement thing. I think it's one of those things that kind of just dissolve, I believe, in your mouth.
Yeah, it's a nicotine pouch.
Yeah.
Zins. Yeah. So it's got...
So you can kind of hide it a little bit more. So you don't, you're not like, you know, they're smoking cigs.
But this isn't like, it's tobacco free, but it's like a nicotine delivery system. So he's doing caffeine and nicotine is what he...
Gets you a little boosted, said. You know? He was taking tons of Zins in that Penn State game.
Yeah, and I...
popped him like his candy.
But I said, my thing is, the Starbucks quad shot iced espresso with chocolate cold foam. You can thank me later for that one. That's like mainlining caffeine. You get the quad shot, you get it iced espresso, quad shot, chocolate cold foam over the top. Gives you a little protein. You don't have the calories. You get the caffeine. That's the delivery system. You just got to make sure you hydrate. And by the way, you can't do like four of those in a day. You got to limit yourself to one. You know, otherwise you're going to be jumping around, acting all jumpy. You know, so there's that. But I was in the gym and I texted Lanning that because I was like, I ate like a couple Snicker bars, you know, in the last 24 hours. I'm like, that's not part of my workout regimen. I got to stay away from the Halloween candy. I literally, like, we criticize the person who comes up and steals the whole bowl of candy. I kind of wish somebody had stole the whole bowl of candy this year.
So you're against Christmas people starting now. So are you against, like, my mom when I drop my kids off today? My mom and my littlest Hudson, who is a Christmas baby, born on Christmas, that, you know, be a little fair, they did the pre-gingerbread houses. They're doing the pre-gingerbread house before the whole family gets together.
It's early, man.
They're getting
Happy
it all
New
together.
Year.
They're getting
Happy
candy
New
together.
Year to your mom.
They're going pre-gingerbread house before the actual gingerbread house, you know, cook-off.
Next week, what, she's doing Thanksgiving? She's doing Valentine's Day?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, like,
St. Patrick's Day?
We're a little New Year. What's her New Year's resolution? While she's at it, making that gingerbread house. Come on. You can't do that. You can't jump holidays. We just fell back an hour. And by the way, I don't feel like I got an hour. People keep asking me, what did I do with that hour? What did you do with that hour? You know what I did? I looked in disbelief at the clock and went, wait a minute. Is that right? And my clock's right? That can't be right.
You're scrolling TikTok.
I gave that free hour to TikTok. All right. Let's do it. We're going to play some Punch It audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
I'm just flattered that Dan Lanning said our age. That's right. That's right, Disco Dan. Mike Parker, Beavers win. Beavers win. Wazoo's kicker misses wide right. Here's Mike Parker, Beavers broadcaster, on the call.
A 33-yard try to tie it for Jack Stevens. 10 for 11 on the year. The snap down, the kick by Stevens is on the way, and it is wide right and no good! Jack Stevens misses the 33-yarder with 1:05 to play, and the Beavers hold the lead at 10-7 and will have the football back at their own 20.
The Beavers fans eventually storm the field. Second win of the season, two in a row for Rob Akey. Oregon State has caught lightning in a bottle. Here's Akey.
That was a hell of a lot of fun, and I think I said it before, but to see our guys smiling the way that they are right now was really, really cool. And to see them overcome adversity and fight themselves through it and find a way to finish. They, you know, they took some steps and moved forward, and that was really, really cool, and I thought that was awesome, and I'm proud of them as can be. I'm proud of this coaching staff, the way they worked with these guys throughout making it happen. And tell you the other thing I thought was pretty cool was the Beaver Nation out there tonight. That was awesome. The folks we had here, they were wound up, and I think it was a big deal to them, and it was good to see them smile.
There he is, Rob Yakey, the interim coach at Oregon
State. Does he have a chance to be the main guy?
I don't think so. I think in order for him to be the main guy, he'd have to win out. And I don't think
five
they are.
And seven, so 5-0.
I also think you'd have to have donors in Scott Barnes' ear saying this has to be the guy. But what I do think Rob Yakey has a chance to do is I think he has a chance to be the holdover coach. Like, there's usually a holdover who sticks around and joins the next staff. I think Yakey has a shot to be that guy. He came up to me pregame on the sideline. And he said, "Hey, I love coming on your show. I love coming on Wednesdays." And I said, "We'll keep it going." I said, "You know, lightning in a bottle. Go win again.
Win here at Oregon State or not, just come on the show, man. He brings the juice
every week. He's got a little juice." Speaking of juice, Will Smith with a game-winning home run in the top of the 11th. Dodgers against the Blue Jays.
Smith hits a high fly ball to deep left field. It's got a chance. There it is, gone. It's Will Smith in game seven. And in the 11th inning of game seven, the Dodgers lead for the first time.
It's not Shohei Ohtani. It's not Freddie Freeman. It's not Mookie Betts. It's Will Smith, the Fresh Prince, with the home run. Here's how it sounded in Espanol.
Rogers hoy con cuatro carreras, pero no lograron en este juego producir en los momentos importantes. Acaba tazo grande, profundo por el jardín izquierdo. La bola tomando altura. Se eleva. Capítulo número 11 para poner en ventaja a los Dodgers. 5-4 ante los azulejos de Toronto. La desapareció por la izquierda. Will Smith lo ganan los Dodgers. 5-4.
There it is in Spanish, much better than in English. Dave Roberts at the Dodgers parade says he wants another one. They've won two straight.
The last thing I say, I talked to a good friend in front of mine yesterday on the plane. And he gave me the okay to use this phrase. Pat Riley, what's better than two? Three P. Let's go.
There it is. They won three. Dodgers fans want three. Dave Roberts wants three. They're outspending everybody, but everybody will be rooting for anybody but the Dodgers next season. Tom Verducci says this was the best Game 7 World Series game in history.
I have a hard time putting it up above Game 7 of 2016. I still go back to that 17-minute rain delay, that pregnant pause in the game. You're like, the game is tied in the World Series, and we're going to stop and have a 17-minute timeout with two teams that hadn't won in forever. And that was another game, by the way, that had so many twists and turns. It wasn't just the end. It was all the pivot points in the course of the game where history was changing minute by minute. This is right up there, though, because, again, I think there was so much to absorb in this game, Dan. Actually, the whole series, where I don't know how many times you thought this, like, the Dodgers are going to win the World Series. The Jays are going to win the World Series, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't have written any better as far as cliffhangers go.
There it is. It was. It had a lot of drama. It had a lot of intrigue, twists and turns, inches this way, inches that way. Blue Jays could have won it just as easily as the Dodgers won it. That's how close the Game 7 was. 162 games, then a division series, and nationally an American League Championship Series. The ALCS went seven games, then a seven-game World Series, and it comes down to a game of inches. Dan Quinn, Commanders coach, made a stunning revelation. Jaden Daniels will miss several games with a dislocated elbow. Quinn says he left Daniels in too long, 100% on him.
I know many of you have been asking about the thought process of Jaden being in the game in that situation. I get that. I've been thinking about it, honestly, nonstop, too, and you know, for me, the answer is, man, I missed it. But I would, you know, I'll fill you in on my thought process. At the start of the fourth quarter, I guess it was probably like 12 and a half minutes left in the game. And that was going to be the last drive for a couple of guys, Jaden and Zach and Debo and LT. And so we weren't going to have any read run plays, and meaning no carries, you know, for the quarterback on a run. And honestly, man, that's where I missed it. Of course, he could scramble. It's Jaden. It's what he's special at. And that is 100% that's on me.
Left him in the game. You know, the game wasn't close. You've got him in the game. It's 38-14. You're trailing.
But at what now point? At what point do you take him out, though? Because I think at that time it was 38-8. Might have been in the fourth quarter. Like, I mean, is that enough? Because you talked about it. The rules are made for games to be close and offenses to score. Like, I understand it's 30-point lead, but like, I mean, is it really? Was it really over at that point? I don't know.
I think it was over when it comes to Jaden Daniels, though.
This is why people like Dan Quinn, though. The players like him. Like, he just took all the blame for it and said, look, this is on me, guys.
And I think it takes, you know, I've been thinking about it nonstop. He lets the air out of the controversy by saying it was 100% on me. Because then everyone's like, okay, you missed it. That's it. There's no fracture here. But he has the injury with 7:39 left, and you're down by 24 points. You know, you're sacked at the 4-yard line. It was 38-7 when he got sacked. So he's down 31 points with 7:39 to go. I have a hard time thinking that you're in a position to come back and win that game. So I like, though, that it shows some leadership, to your point, that he's saying, hey, it's on him. Cam Little with a record 68-yard field goal against the Raiders.
68 yards away. It's up there. It's out there. And it's good! It's good from 68!
Kick it long enough, kick it straight enough, and it'll go in. There it was, 68 yards. Longest field goal in league history as time expired in the second
quarter. How long does that record hold for? Like a week?
The way these kickers are going, you know, the more and more they're making 50-plus yarders. They're getting better. I kind of wonder what happens to the kicking game. What happens, you know, do they start making a 4-point play? Like, they're playing indoors. You're playing on surfaces that are nice to kick off of. You're playing with balls that'll fly. I love the way he talked about it, too. He's just like, you know, you kick it straight enough, you kick it long enough, and it goes in. Leave it here. The 5 at 5 is next.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
No more leftover Halloween candy for me. I gotta steer clear of it. That's my new thing. I always feel like if you go to the gym, you can't, like, go to the gym and then stop off for a chimichanga at, like, 7-Eleven on the way home. You're just treading water. You got to make it count. We've got the 5 at 5 coming up here. 5 biggest stories in sports. We're going to lead you right into Monday Night Football. Who you got in Monday Night Football, Steven? What are you thinking?
Well, the point spread is it's Cardinals at Cowboys. Point spread was 3 the last time I looked. Cowboys favored by 3. I feel like I should be a little higher than 3 points. That makes me think the Cardinals are going to win, so I'm going to go Cardinals.
All right. I am I'm looking ahead at this. I'm trying to figure out 3.5. Over-under should be in the 50s.
Like the Cardinals, without Kyler, Jacoby Brissett's the quarterback, the Cowboys, like they still have a good offense. You would think they'd be able to do something. It seems like this point spread should be higher, and it's not, which makes me think the Cardinals win.
Yeah, the Cardinals have won 3 straight against the Cowboys, and they won their last 3 times at Dallas. They've won, but we'll see. Dallas doesn't have any defense. Their defense is so bad, so maybe that's a factor here. But Steven, there, your pick is noted. Although I think your logic is a little bit all over the place. You're on the books. We're gonna do the 5 biggest stories in sports. Plus, I have something to say about those 5 stories. Let's go.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, John, tomorrow the college football playoffs will deliver their first rankings. So that makes this AP poll actually very important, because a lot of times in past history, college football playoff just follows the AP poll. So the AP poll for this week, top 25, Ohio State number 1, Indiana 2, Texas A&M 3, Alabama 4, Georgia 5. That rounds out the top 5. Now the Oregon Ducks, they are in at number 6. Followed by Ole Miss, BYU, Texas Tech, and Notre Dame. But for Oregon, I think this is a little important. Now, they play Iowa this week, who is 6-2, not ranked. But they still play USC. They're ranked number 20. And they still play Washington, ranked 24. We know how important those top 25 wins can be in the college football playoff rankings. So Oregon still has two teams that on their schedule that are ranked, and Iowa right outside the top 25. So maybe there is a little bit of stuff that Oregon can work with going on later this season. It seemed like at the start of the year, they may not get a lot of ranked wins. Well, they beat Penn State, but that's turned out to be not great. They lose to Indiana. Now they still can have maybe have a couple ranked wins if they can pull off some of these wins all season.
I'm curious to see where Oregon ends up, because they're 6 in the AP poll. I've heard people speculate that the college football playoff poll might penalize them a little more for the lack of quality wins. I think there'll be 6 or 7. Some people have said that they could fall as low as 8. Keep an eye on BYU. 8-0 BYU is ranked 8th in the AP top 25
and
poll.
Double-digit underdogs this week.
Yeah, but could they slip in front of Oregon for this week? Like, BYU and Texas Tech have been positioned on by the AP voters as, these two teams in the Big 12. They're at 8 and 9 in the AP poll. And, seemingly one of them is going to surge ahead. I also am curious to see where the top group of 5 team ends up. Right now it would probably be Memphis. They're at 22 in the AP poll. San Diego State is unranked in the AP poll. I'm curious to see where they hit number 25 in this poll. A lot to be determined. But Oregon's season is in their own hands. The Ducks, they go to Iowa. They get the Friday night game against Minnesota at home. They get USC at home. Then they go to Washington to finish the year. You win out, you're in the playoff, and you're probably hosting a home game in the playoff. I don't think they're going to end up in position to play in the Big Ten championship game, but they're in good shape. But question two for the Big Ten conference is: it'll be Ohio State, it'll be Indiana, it'll be Oregon. Where's the 4th highest ranked Big Ten team going to fall? Because right now that would be USC at 20. What does the committee do? I'll tell you what you can be sure of on Tuesday night. 24 hours from now, as the first rankings for the CFP poll are released, the committee is going to be criticized by the SEC, the Big Ten. Athletic directors are going to be mad. Coaches are going to be mad. Fans are going to be ready to throw Molotov cocktails through the windows of the committee. No one's going to be happy, Steven.
I was going to say, will anybody be happy?
Nobody will be happy.
Okay.
ESPN, they're going to be like, oh, the SEC got hosed.
The only team that could be happy is Indiana if they're number 1. That's the only way I could see one school being happy about anything.
Yeah, Ohio State, Indiana, Texas A&M, Alabama currently in the top 4 spots in the AP poll. We'll see what the playoff selection committee does. But for anybody who doesn't think the AP poll matters, that committee's working off the AP poll. You'll know it tomorrow when they release their rankings. It'll be obvious.
Number 2.
Well, the Seahawks just absolutely crushed the Commanders last night on Sunday Night Football, 38-14 in Washington. Ben, it's just worse news now as Commanders quarterback Jane Daniels, he dislocated his left elbow with less than 8 minutes left in that game. Head coach Dan Quinn said that they are still determining the next course of action, but that Daniels will be out for a while. Good news was his x-ray after the game showed no fracture and just a dislocation. So, it could have been a lot worse. But, the Commanders were down big by about 30 points late in that fourth quarter when Jaden got hurt. And head coach Dan Quinn said it was 100% on him for having Daniels out there. Remember, it was just last year, John. Jaden Daniels and the Commanders went to the NFC title game. He was the next great thing. I still believe in Jaden Daniels. I still think he's awesome. But, man, this has been a tough year for him. 3-6, and now Jaden out for a while. I can't imagine he plays anymore this season.
The NFL's trade deadline is tomorrow. A lot of teams saying they're going to be active. The Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones has already sort of head faked that they've made a trade. Maybe that has something to do with the spread tonight, Stephen. But they've made a trade, but we'll see. you know, what happens, what goes down in front of the deadline officially tomorrow. But disappointing year for the Commanders. They had sky-high expectations. I think people, a lot of people had them penciled into the Super Bowl. They're not getting there.
Number three.
Well, we talked a little bit about Cam Little, the Jaguars kicker, kicking the NFL record 68-yard field goal against the Raiders on Sunday at halftime. But now Little has to beat another record, and that is pass a drug test. Because right after the game, John, Cam Little went to social media, and he posted a little note that he got in his locker that said, you need to go take a drug test right now. And he just replied with, like, already? Like, this is happening just because I made a 68-yard field goal? But I thought that was pretty funny that he makes the 68-yard record-setting field goal right away. Random drug test for you. Make sure you are clean and ready to go.
That doesn't feel random. That feels like he may have been singled out for kicking the ball so far. I'm sure he didn't mind. Welcome to the NFL.
Number four.
Man, Game 7 was such a good game between the Blue Jays and Dodgers. Dodgers win that and win the World Series, but it had two monster home runs, one by Miguel Rojas to tie the game in the top of the ninth, and then the game winner by Will Smith in the 11th. Both those home runs, John, went to left field, just cleared the bullpen. Well, the interesting part was John Baines. He was the guy who caught the Miguel Rojas home run. Two innings later, his son, Matthew Baines, caught the go-ahead home run by Will Smith. But there was some controversy because people saw them throw baseballs back on the field after each home run, but the father, John, has come out and said that they did the old switcheroo. They brought decoy balls. They switched them real quickly, threw out the decoy ball, hung on to the actual ball. So two Blue Jay fans, father and son, caught the Miguel Rojas home run, caught the Will Smith home run. I imagine maybe the Dodgers are going to try to reach out to them and try to make a deal, get those baseballs, or someone will. But kind of a cool and interesting story, but I don't know what to believe.
Do you think I saw the kid. The kid's was more obvious. The dad was very subtle.
Do you think they pulled the old switcheroo?
I think they probably did. Yeah, I think they. The fans
his quote
that are
was
out,
that they needed to be ready just in case it was like a Shohei or Vladdy home run. That they had the old decoy.
They
ball.
Came prepared, man. They came prepared, and the fans in Toronto, they were cheering when he threw the ball back onto the field.
Number five.
And then when it is a big sports night, Monday Night Football, Cardinals taking on the Cowboys, Beavers, Oregon State, basketball taking on North Dakota State in their college basketball opener. And most importantly, John, the 4-2 fighting Portland Trailblazers taking on the Lakers, who will be without LeBron, Luka, and Austin Reeves from the Moda Center. I tell you what, Lakers played last night. This is the second game in a back-to-back. I think teams are going to do this to the Blazers. They don't want to go against that pressure, especially these vets. If the teams are playing on back-to-back, we could see some guys just doing the old load management. That's what Luka and Austin Reeves are doing against the Blazers. Blazers are 8.5, 9-point favorites tonight against the Lakers.
Yeah, the Blazers looking good. They're playing with a lot of energy. They are 4-2 this season. I noticed the odds, Stephen. I said last Friday that the odds for the Blazers to make the playoffs were 4-1 on DraftKings. Mm. They're now down to +195, just under 2-1 to make the playoffs. I think Vegas thinks they're going to make the playoffs all of a sudden. Some of this is they're getting wins in the early part of the season. I share some skepticism that they won't try to move somebody like Jeremy Grant before the deadline. That could affect their trajectory dramatically. But right now they're kind of fun. They're interesting. They're playing hard, and they're 4-2. That's a winning basketball team you've got. So Blazers, Rip City, you've got a winner so far. All right, we're back tomorrow with another great show. We're leading you right into Monday Night Football. Stick around.